This episode is sponsored by Smart Travel, a new podcast from NerdWallet. You know that one friend who always finds the best travel deals, picks the right cards, and somehow ends up in first class for the price of coach? Well, Smart Travel is like that friend, but in podcast form. They cover all things travel finance, like which airport lounges are worth it and which are basically free Wi-Fi and chairs, and how travel advisors can snag secret perks you didn't even know to ask for, or how to get real value from points, not just a tiny reward at checkout. Travel smarter and spend less with help from Nerd Wallet. Follow Smart Travel wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a Voyascape podcast. You can find all of our travel podcasts from around the world at voyascape.com.
And welcome to the Frommer Travel Show. I'm your host, Pauline Frommer. You know, Napoleon famously said, "An army moves on its stomach." You could say the same for tourists. More and more of us travel to eat. But where should we be going, and what types of food are actually authentic nowadays? What are the newest trends in dining at important cities around the world? My next guest has her finger on the culinary pulse. Her name is Danielle Chang. She has a wonderful, really zen, insightful show called Lucky Chang. It's on PBS. Danielle, it's an honor and a delight to speak with you.
It's an honor to be speaking with you, Pauline.
So tell our listeners about the show first. How does it approach food?
Yeah, Lucky Chow really approaches food through the language of culture. So it's through the lens of culture, whether it's an Asian tradition or a spiritual follower or a festival, we approach food through these cultural lenses.
Right. But what's so interesting to me is the season that I saw concentrated on Europe, but you looked at it through the lens, I think, and tell me if this is wrong, of Asian culture, of how the world is a far more interconnected place than many want to admit. And so when you go to, say, Paris, you might have a really authentic meal there by going to a Vietnamese restaurant, right?
Absolutely. Actually, Paris has the largest concentration of Vietnamese outside of Vietnam. Very few people know that, in fact, but their so-called Chinatown, the 13th arrondissement, is mostly full of Vietnamese who were born there. So, you know, the second generation of immigrants, they see French food differently than the first generation.
Right.
So their food is super authentic to them because it's a combination of the Vietnamese food that their grandmothers and their moms made for them when they first, when they were growing up in France. But it's also fused with French cultural know-how, having grown up in, you know, this other country.
Right, right. No, I thought it was fascinating. You go to Copenhagen, where many chefs are using the local produce and the local fish to create food that we would think of as maybe Japanese or Chinese or from a different culture than the Scandinavian one. Yeah. And it's actually, I thought this was so fascinating, it's actually shaping what some farmers there are planting, right?
Yes. You know what was so fascinating? When my producers first said, "Let's go to Copenhagen," I said, "Listen, the place has 0.03% of its population as Asians, you know. There's not going to be any stories there for us to find. I know Copenhagen is the capital of fine dining, but I was so surprised because so many of the top restaurants there are actually helmed by Asian chefs, many of whom grew up in Copenhagen or in Scandinavia. And you're right, there are farms, because farmers are the new rock stars in the Copenhagen dining scene. It's like, move over, chefs, what have you got for us? That's different. And so there is this chef, Jonathan Tam, who worked with Dan Barber at Blue Hill, and they brought in some seeds and grew things like Tokyo turnips and other Asian delicacies that you usually don't find in Scandinavia. And it's because of the Scandinavian terroir, obviously, the vegetables turned out different. So it's a mix of Scandinavian and Asia. We liked, that's why the episode is called Scandinasia.
Yeah, no, I love that. And at one point, you taste Celtus,
yes,
which is a kind of like asparagus-like lettuce. Mm-hmm. And I had Celtus for the first time recently in New York City.
Oh.
At a restaurant called Lai, which is it's an Asian wine,
yes,
bar. So another type of fusion. And it was delightful. I had no idea that this vegetable even existed.
Yeah, it's actually very easy to grow as well. And I'm growing it this year, and it's delicious. The Celtus, it just kind of bolts out of the ground, and you can eat it raw or steamed or chopped. And a lot of chefs, even like John George Mongerishtin at ABC Kitchen, has become a huge connoisseur of this very humble Chinese lettuce stem. So
yeah,
it's fun to see that happening.
No, absolutely. And what I love about the series is you're looking at European cities and culture through an Asian lens, but the stories are so different city by city. Mm-hmm. So, for example, in London, it really all becomes about the history of colonialism, to my mind.
Yes.
And how tea, for example, is the most British thing. And yet it never was grown in Britain. It's a product of colonialism. And I loved your section about high tea. Can you talk a little bit about the etiquette surrounding high tea and also the history of tea in the UK?
Yes. The tea trade started wars, and a lot of what the British see as everyday British culture, like afternoon tea or spices, chicken tikka masala, the chicken tikka curry dish was actually declared to be the national dish of the UK because they were so proud of having such a diverse group of people coexisting together. But in reality, chicken tikka masala is a British-made dish made by immigrants as a kind of British curry that would curry favor with the palate there. But in terms of afternoon tea, it's such a quintessential British pastime, right? To be served these dainty tea sandwiches and then teacups and the beautiful porcelain. And my Chinese friend, who was born in Hong Kong but immigrated to Hong Kong, to London, met me for afternoon tea with my British friend who grew up drinking afternoon tea. And she was the one that had all the insights on etiquette. Like, for instance, women have to turn their napkins sort of inside out so that you can dab your lipstick on the sides of your mouth, when you're eating sandwiches. You can't stir your coffee or tea aggressively. You kind of just move your teaspoon back and forth softly across the cup. You have to take the sandwich that's closest to the edge. You can't just pick at the one in the middle.
Yeah, and your British friend was talking about why they are dainty sandwiches. It's because it's this elevated form of social interaction, and you don't want to show a gaping maw.
Right.
You don't want to open your mouth too widely when you're interacting in this polite way.
Right. And, you know, we all have our version of afternoon tea, you know, maybe a cup of coffee. But, you know, in that episode, I always also show these two Burmese sisters who are medical doctors also, by the way. And they hosted me for a Burmese afternoon tea at their house where we ate the tea, you know, tea fermented in Burmese culture. And it's tossed with peanuts, spices, pickled vegetables, other things. And is a snack that you just munch on while you're having your cup of tea.
Right. But it gives you the same buzz as tea. I've had tea salad and I felt very awake afterwards. I wasn't expecting that.
And like a nice buzz, right? Like a nice heal energy.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I thought it was fascinating that London's Chinatown, as you say in the episode, had to do with the fact that you had merchants of Chinese descent who were coming to London, 200 years ago? And they helped create this area of London that's now right in the center of the city because they wanted a place that felt like home when they were in the city. I thought that was such an interesting insight. Yeah.
It was actually in the South Docks when they first established it, but then quickly it moved into the city in the center when it wasn't yet as touristy and gentrified, you know. So you usually find Chinatowns in the outskirts of the city.
Yeah. And I loved the point that your guest made about, well, what is Chinatown? What is authentic Chinese food? Does it have to be a sit-down restaurant, or can it be, you know, somewhere where you just pick up a dumpling? So tell us a little bit about London's Chinatown, if you would.
Well, London's Chinatown is right in the middle of the city. It's right by Soho, Piccadilly Circus, Trafalgar Square. It's like you can go and tuck into the pub or a theater, or you can go down this very, it's a pedestrian, but quite orientalized street, you know, with red lanterns hanging everywhere. And it's a hub for just street food. You know, you can find banquet restaurants and you can find dim sum, but there's also a lot of young British entrepreneurs that are just opening up fun street food. And a lot of that is inspired by all the fun food coming out of Asia and Korea, in particular China. But we did feature this one entrepreneur who made cream puffs with traditional ingredients. But, you know, it's a franchise that she's actually hoping to spread throughout Europe, you know.
Right.
And then there are also legacy restaurants. There, we talked to Marina Lylands, who owns Golden Phoenix. She actually took over the restaurant last year when her father unexpectedly died. And she was working abroad at the time and decided to carry on her father's legacy. But she has a young family and she's very committed to doing things her way. So she wants to elevate the cuisine that's being served in a dim sum restaurant. And she has this one line where she says, you know, this sweet and sour pork, you know, the double fried Peking duck, all these things were what got us here. But this food, the elevated dim sum that she's serving as afternoon tea, is what I want us to be remembered for. So I love that she's carrying this generational knowledge of cuisine.
Yeah. No, I thought that was very moving, actually. Yeah. She talked about how probably her father wouldn't have wanted her to take over the restaurant.
Yeah, but there she is. That, you know, back in the 60s and 70s, when most of our parents immigrated to the U.S., they weren't working in the restaurant industry back home, but laundry businesses, restaurant businesses was where they could get their start. And oftentimes it led them to be able to create the American dream, which is having children that don't have to work in the restaurant.
Right. Yeah. No, that was very moving. And in the segment right before it, you solved a mystery for me. I have always wondered how you are actually supposed to eat those soft buns that have very gooey interiors. Yes. And you're the person who was showing you through this, who owns a bun shop. She said you break off one part of it and then you use it to dip.
Yeah, and I thought that's so clever. But of course, I didn't take her advice.
Yeah, I thought that was really clever. I also realized after watching your show that I ate at all the wrong places when I was in Berlin last year. I only had heavy Teutonic food, mm-hmm. and it got tiresome very quickly. But just the level of creativity that's going into the cuisine of Berlin. Can you talk a little bit about the food artist who starts that segment?
Well, Berlin is, the government is very kind to providing artist subsidies. So a lot of creative types go there. And I mean, they say that, oh, Berlin isn't what it was like 10, 20 years ago. But we all say that, you know, about wherever we grew up. But
sure,
it still allows a level, it still allows artists to make work and make a living. There's a lot of housing subsidies. So even in the last scene of that episode where I feature a Korean woman who was an opera singer turned fermentator turned Michelin star chef, you know, she is subsidized by the government, which was how she was able to explore all these creative avenues, having come from South Korea. But there is a lot of Asian food there, and there are a lot of artists who are working with food as a medium. So they create these beautiful tableaux of food, you know, dressing a dining room table with food as if it were an edible art installation.
Yeah. And when you say dressing it, I think most people would think, oh, a nice plating. No. Yes. The artist that you talked about had kind of fabric on the table that was molded into little mountains. And then there were rice crackers just scattered here and there and other pieces of food. And it really looked like an art piece that would be in a museum. And yet it was being created to be, I guess, like a Buddhist mandala, to be eaten, to be destroyed.
Yeah. And I wish that you had been there with us because the food was so good, too. I was like, this can't possibly taste good. It's rice crackers with, you know, but she made all sorts of jams, like banana blossom, which is like a Filipino ketchup of sorts. And so I love how she was educating the audience while just tantalizing them with their eyes and their senses, you know, because you're like, what is that herb? I love the crunch of this rice cracker, you know, it just introduces you to a whole new cultural appetite that you're not familiar with.
Well, this leads me to a question about how you produce the show. How did you find her? Does she do this regularly, or did you have to seek her out to have that type of meal?
You know, she actually does this regularly, and there's a group of Filipino artists that are all hyphenated people, you know, florist slash artist slash opera singer slash writer slash poet.
Right.
And they're just so, they're vibing on Berlin. And I think really just living their best lives in this community that's founded also on being part of this Filipino diaspora, you know, of people who've come from all around the world to seek out the freedom that a place like Berlin has to offer them. How I found them, I have to give credit to my amazing producer, Clarissa Way. She produced season 7 as well and is the James Beard Award nominated writer of the cookbook Made in Taiwan. And she, based in Taiwan, found the majority of these people. And we also had local fixers in every country, and that was invaluable, who did location scouting, pre-interviews with all the talent, translated for us, gave us a lot of transportation advice. You know, we were faced with strikes and bus.
Oh boy.
Delays.
Yeah, Europe, you know, strikes all, happens.
Yeah, yeah, all the fun stuff is traveling through Europe.
Yeah, yeah. How many are in your crew? And I have to tell you, I really enjoyed the cinematography of your show. I thought it just looks so painterly. A lot of the compositions of the food were absolutely gorgeous.
That's the work of my work husband, Francisco Ollie Wallace, who is probably the best cinematographer, DP, editor, all-around person that you could be lucky enough to work with. He's produced the majority of the Lucky Child episodes, and he literally is one man with a camera. So it's just the two of us on the shoots with a fixer, and, you know, Clarissa calling in and helping with the post. But Fran actually edits his own material too. And we're so in tune that we only need a couple of iterations. Like, it's crazy. We always surprise ourselves at how willing people are to open up to us and tell us their stories. And that's what makes this so good, I think.
Yeah, I would think having just one crew member with you probably helps with that, because it's not, you know, 20 people gathered around pointing their attention at the person you're talking to.
We're very mobile and we seek out opportunities, you know, like if you look at all the shots of people just on the street having fun, like he's excellent at capturing B-roll and just the general zeitgeist and sense of belonging in a place.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you definitely get that. And I think the show does something important. I think it shows how interconnected culture is and always has been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think there's a movement to silo us.
Yes.
And, you know, I mean, you think of Italian food. The Italians did not invent pasta. They didn't have pasta until a couple of hundred years ago, you know, that came probably, although we don't know. There's a wonderful book called On the Noodle Road, which tries to find where pasta came from. And eventually the author throws up her hands because there's no definitive answer. It didn't come from Italy.
Right. But I was talking to a restaurateur who is just now serving hand-pulled Chinese noodles in Italy. Hmm. And he first immigrated to Italy and served Italian pasta, like bolognese, because he said, you know, and he hid his Chinese face. He said nobody wanted to eat Chinese food, much less that cooked from a Chinese person. And now, just to show how times and cultural attitudes have shifted, he has a hand-pulled noodle place that's doing very well in Milan, where you can see the chefs in the window pulling the noodles, you know.
Wow.
And I went to this place called Prato, which is just out 20 minutes outside of Florence, and it actually has the largest concentration of Chinese people in all of Europe outside.
Huh.
Yeah, it has like 15% Chinese population, because they were all sent from this one province, Wenzhou in China, to work in the garment industry there, as sewers.
Sure.
And so that the clothing could be made in Italy, even though they're by Chinese people. So a whole Chinatown popped up around there. And now they have Prato dumplings, you know, like Italian ravioli skin with Chinese ingredients inside, you know, like a true fusion that just is so authentic because it grew out of the natural, you know, confluence of the Chinese in Italy working together to create an industry. So I think, you know, to talk a little bit about authenticity, whatever food that comes out of, you know, the conjoining of cultures or people coming together to eat something shared is authentic.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, I love that. So if people want to watch the show, I know it can be sometimes tricky on PBS because shows are on at different hours. Mm-hmm. Where can they get the information about the show? Lucky Chow, yes. It is called once again. How do they find out where
it's
they can watch it?
Actually, free for all PBS viewers. So it's just pbs.org/shows/Lucky-Chow. And you can watch all the season 8 in Europe doesn't come out till May 1st, but seasons 1 through 7 are on the PBS station now.
Oh, very cool. Very cool. Well, it's been such a delight getting to meet you. Likewise. I so enjoyed the show.
Thank you so much.
Of course. And thank you for being on the Fromer Travel Show.
Thank you. It was lovely.
That is it for this week's show. I thank you so much for watching and listening. And to those who are traveling, may I wish you a hearty bon voyage. I'll see you next week.
for coming home. I like you with your sour candy in the boathouse on the lake. But I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes. Oh, it's been so long. And I cannot help but wonder, are you ever coming home? When I see you with your sour candy, don't want it any other way. Oh, I just hate, I hate, I hate, I hate, I hate. I hate the way it tastes.
Hey guys, Aaron Miller here from Armchair Explorer, and I just wanted to let you know that our new series is out now. We've got kite skiing across Antarctica, Aboriginal storytellers, and the craziest whitewater race in the world. We're going on a bucket list hike across Italy. We're going to the fjords of Norway in search of the Northern Lights, and lots, lots more. Our goal is to take you on the trip of a lifetime every single week. You can find Armchair Explorer on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you're listening right now, and at voyescape.com.
If you want to travel more, ideally in luxury, but without the luxury price tag, this show is for you. I'm DeAndre Koch, and on Revolutionizing Your Journey, I use my unique vantage point as a financial advisor to break down exactly how my wife and I leverage credit card points and miles to fly business class, stay at five-star resorts, and take bucket list trips for a fraction of the cost. Each week, I share real strategies packed with actionable tips and interview some of the smartest travelers in the game to help you revolutionize the way you travel. Travel well, live boldly, and find Revolutionizing Your Journey wherever you get your podcasts.